Radio City Talks Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Yeah, Mental Health Monday is here for another week. My name is Mick and we're here to talk about mental health. It's as simple as that. We've got a guest in the studio who's going to be sharing her story, her experiences, and she is somebody who has presented a documentary which you may have seen on TV. She's a Mind Media Award winner as well, and she's also sat on the All Party Parliamentary Group for Suicide Prevention as well. If you want to get involved in the programme and talk about your own story, absolutely get in contact with us. Drop us an email, mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. Ryan sent an email. He said some lovely things about the programme. I just want to thank producer Lizzie and Mick for putting together such an important show. I was listening back to previous episodes and got myself up to speed. I'm really impressed that we have such a forward-thinking show running in Liverpool. Mental health is such a tricky topic to cover, but you do it really well, and I think you're really helping to bring these issues out in the open and help reduce stigma. Thanks again and very best wishes, Ryan. Ryan, thank you for that. That's why we do the programme. We really appreciate your feedback. mick@radiocity.co.uk if you'd like to add to that, or if there's something about the show you think we're missing, if there's a particular angle that we're not touching on, do drop us an email. If there are phrases which we use on the programme we shouldn't be using anymore because they're outdated, tell us about it. mick@radiocity.co.uk. That's mick@radiocity.co.uk. Angela Samata joins us in the studio. Angela, thank you for your time. Really appreciate you coming on the programme today. Your experience of mental health is a really sad one. First and foremost, you have taken yourself, though, on a journey which has seen you stand on the Mind Media Award winner stage, collecting a prize for a documentary that you worked on. People may have seen your documentary as well. Just tell us about the documentary and how it came about, because this was after the death of your partner.
Yeah, so first of all, can I say thanks for asking me? I kind of feel like I've arrived because there's such you've had such amazing people on the show, and this show is so important. So many people talk about it, and it's so important to kind of have this every Monday. And so thanks for asking me. That yeah, I kind of feel like I've arrived. That's good.
Have I gone red now?
He has gone red. The show came about, the film came about because in 2003, my partner Mark took his life. And he was one of the, you know, now I know all the figures. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? He was one of the 75% of people who don't contact any services before they end their lives. And because of that, we didn't know that Mark was feeling suicidal. And I still don't know how long he'd been feeling suicidal for. It could have been 15 minutes. It could have been, you know, 15 months. I've got no idea because he didn't tell anybody how he was feeling. And I actually spoke to him about 6 o'clock on the phone, and I said to him that I was on my way home and I'd see him when I got home. And the two things that he said to me that were really memorable in that call, and he told me that he loved me, which he always did, which was lovely. But then he also said he was sorry. And I thought he was apologising for the fact that he hadn't gone to work that day. Unusually, he'd phoned in sick. And I'd got a series of phone calls from his boss saying, you know, where is he and is everything all right? And it was all very unusual. So by the time I spoke to him, I was, you know, there was a mixture of relief, but also kind of, you know, I wasn't very happy. I was kind of like, why have you been off, you know? So our phone call ended that I said to him, I'll speak to you when I get home. And it was that kind of, you know, that one that only your partner can do. I'll speak to you when I get home. And so I took our kids, who were 3 and 13, and got in the car and drove home. And unfortunately, it was then, about 15 minutes after I'd spoken to him, I realised that he wasn't apologising for the fact that he hadn't gone to work. He was apologising for the fact that I was going to walk in and find that he'd actually taken his life. And that kind of changed everything in that moment. All of our lives changed. My kids, you know, had just lost their dad. I had just lost Mark. Mark's family had just lost him. My family. There was so many people at his funeral, I couldn't even begin to count them. And it really opened up a whole other world for me. So I worked in the arts and I continue to work in the arts today. And I used to run the John Moores Painting Prize here in Liverpool. And it opened up a whole other world, the world that looks at mental health, the world that looks at suicide and why people feel suicidal. And so for the last kind of 14 years, because that's, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying that, it's 14 years since Mark took his life. I've really worked across the two two areas. So the art, you know, carry on working in the art world, but now I also work in the mental health world. And when the BBC guys came to me and asked if I would make a film about the most vulnerable time in our lives, I kind of wasn't really sure what to say. At that point, I'd spent, you know, the previous 12 years trying to encourage people to talk about how they were feeling. You know, I don't want there to be another person like me. I don't want there to be another person like Mark. So I'd spent a long time really trying to encourage people to talk about their feelings and how, you know, suicide bereavement and how that affects your mental health. So when the BBC came to me, I immediately spoke to my kids. And the boys were kind of, I don't know, Alexei was about 25 and Benjamin was 15 at the time. And Benjamin said, who was three when his dad died, said, "Mum, we should do it. If it helps one person, we should do it," you know. And I was like really proud of him at that moment. And Alexei said to me, "Don't touch it with a barge pole. It's going to be terrible. It's going to, they're going to make us out to be kind of, you know, strange, and it's going to be really awful." And so it was kind of, I had the two kids kind of with completely different views. Anyway, we did it, and we talked to Alexei about what his reservations were, and we kind of made sure that both of the boys were represented in the film in the way they wanted to be represented. And you know, Alexei didn't want to talk about his dad. He wanted to be defined by what he does now, not what happened to us. But Benjamin was very happy to talk about it. So I worked with an amazing team. They were absolutely phenomenal. And they listened to what the boys said, and they were both represented in that film in the way that they wanted to be represented.
It's called Life After Suicide. Is it still available? People find it still online?
Well, it's been shown on BBC One about four times now. And every time it's shown, they put it back on iPlayer for a while. And then there's this constant battle between, are they going to keep it on iPlayer permanently? Are they not? And it's been seen now by about 4.5 million people.
Oh, wow.
There's lots of versions of it on YouTube. Some of them aren't great. So the only thing I can say is that have a look on my Twitter. And people, when they upload it to YouTube, send me the link. And I tend to put the latest link up. And that's where it is.
Given what you've experienced in the amount of time now you've been sort of in and around the world of mental health,
yeah.
If there was a number between 0 and 100 of what you knew back then to what you know now, was it like...
It's 100.
100. Does it go from 0 to 100?
No, honestly, like I was 32, my kids were 3 and 13, and I worked in an art gallery. You know, I don't think I'd ever even... It just doesn't come into your head in your wildest imagination. You just don't ever think about that. You know, I wouldn't watch kind of, you know, thriller films or anything, or, you know, it just wasn't part of our life. I can't stress to you enough how much it just kind of wasn't anywhere near our radar. And so from the thing that changed things for me was really thinking about, after we got over the shock, was thinking about how long had Mark felt that, like that, how long had he kept those feelings to himself? And I think what happened was our experience started to become, you know, when people knew how we'd lost him, other people would say to me, actually, I lost my dad that way, or I lost my sister that way. And what became very apparent very quickly was how many people around me had either had mental health issues themselves and indeed attempted to take their lives, or had been bereaved by suicide. And I genuinely was shocked. I think we all were. When people knew how we'd lost him, so many people wanted to talk about it, you know. And, you know, you there were people that I'd known for years who I never realised that they'd lost family members. And it really opened my eyes to the scale of the problem, that suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50, that, you know, that it is a public health emergency, you know, that over 6,000 people a year in this country take their lives. And so when I say it opened up a whole other world, it really did. And I never thought about Mark as having a mental health issue. You know, I never thought of that. And somebody said to me once, they said, if only I'd driven quicker, if only I'd got there quicker. And that was my constant 4 o'clock in the morning thought. Anybody who's been through what we've been through will know 4 o'clock in the morning very well, has probably seen it as often as I've seen it. And it was always the same question, if I'd driven quicker. And after the film aired, I blogged for the Huffington Post, and I blogged about If Only I'd Driven Quicker, because I kind of just needed to get it out of my head. And so many people got in touch and said, how do you know that that was the first time? How do you know? Because I just presumed that it was the first time that Mark had felt suicidal or indeed attempted to take his life. But actually somebody got in touch and said, you know, how do you know it was the first time? And that just bowled me over, because I'd never, ever thought that there could have been previous times.
Was there ever, when you speak to people now who maybe explain their own experiences, maybe their own thoughts, are there maybe behavioural things that they've talked about that you've found recollections of maybe events where he wasn't quite himself, or he just didn't seem to be, you know, part of the party or whatever it was?
Yep. Now, you know, now, again, hindsight is amazing, isn't it? I think, first of all, when you've been bereaved by suicide in the way that we have, you know, it's called complex grief for a reason. And whenever anybody starts to talk to me about their experience, the power of the emotions that I felt on that day, I can kind of, I'm right back there, you know, right back there. And I think that's the true kind of nature of it, really. You know, it affects you that strongly that, you know, you can just, it's like 14 years haven't passed. It could be 14 minutes, you know, and I'm right back there. But I think that when I look at Mark and I look at, I don't know, maybe his alcohol consumption in the run up to the events that happened, maybe it was the fact that we were going through a bit of a rocky patch. You know, we decided neither of us were happy. We'd been together since we were teenagers. Both of us felt stifled within our relationship. And so we decided to live apart for a while. But that, together with his, you know, now I know how to piece those small things together, seemingly small things together. Now I know that often there isn't one huge thing that means that somebody is going to feel suicidal. Often it is that cumulative effect of smaller, seemingly, you know, negligent things that happen in someone's life that can actually come together to kind of create a perfect storm, really.
Angela's sharing her story on Mental Health Monday. Angela, you're talking about it in such a sort of, I don't know, just such a relaxed way. It's the most horrific thing that you've experienced. And I think anybody listening will just think, wow, how is she able to cope and talk about it in such a calm and measured way? You know, you say that 14 years could be 14 minutes.
Mm.
Do you sort of wrestle with that idea of how do I remember that? Or how do I remember good times within a relationship? How do I remember that relationship versus how do I move on with my life in a positive way without sort of brushing it all to one side and pretending it never happened? Because many people you speak to who have had mental health crisis and they've had that's come to a moment in time, often it's the break away from that moment. They constantly describe themselves as being within that moment, as opposed to being able to sort of move on. Do you feel like your life has, your journey has continued beyond that point 14 years on?
It couldn't be for nothing. You know, Mark would not have wanted that. I truly believe that at the moment, I mean, I've spoken to lots and lots of people who have felt suicidal or have attempted to take their lives, and I'm very fortunate and I count myself as very privileged that people often tell me that about their experiences. And the one thing that everybody says, whoever they are, however old they are, you know, whatever walk of life they're from, at that moment, they truly believed that everybody that they loved would be better off without them. And it's not that they are selfish. You know, it's absolutely abhorrent when people say to me that people who feel suicidal are selfish. I hate it. It's actually because they feel selfless. You know, it's about putting everybody else first. It's about taking themselves out of the equation so that they're not a burden and they're not, you know, they're not bringing more trouble or, you know, whatever. And I think that Mark probably felt like that. And it just couldn't be for nothing. I felt compelled to use our experience because the worst thing had already happened. So when we made the film, it felt like a privilege when people would tell me their stories and people would allow me into their homes. And, you know, and it still feels that way when somebody tells me that they felt suicidal or that they're actively suicidal at the moment. It feels like a privilege because if you're the person that individual has chosen to tell, it's a real privilege to be let into somebody's life and somebody's thoughts in that way. And so I think that we have to recognise those opportunities, because often, I don't know, with men especially, you get one moment to intervene. And you might be a taxi driver and you've got someone in the back of your cab who's telling you that they're not feeling great. And I think to know what to do with that, if you say to somebody, are you feeling suicidal? And someone says yes, knowing what to do next is it. That's it, isn't it? That's the gold. Mm. You know, knowing what to do is a phenomenal thing.
But also, and you know, you talk about the people that have spoken to you, and we find doing this as well, there is such warmth within, and I'll call it the mental health community. It's not really a mental health community, it's just people. But there is this warmth of shared experiences, and they might only be shadows of shared experiences. They might be, you know, almost exactly the same story, but there's connections between people, and they share the stories because they know that those real base emotions that they felt over a particular issue are echoed in either people that have been lost or families who've been affected. It's those same, almost like tones of emotions.
But I think some people haven't got a voice. You know, some people don't get asked to, you know, people like you don't ask everybody. You can't ask everybody to talk about their experience. So the way that I see it, and again, when the BBC came to me, the way that I see it is that I will continue to use my voice until everybody else finds theirs, because it's not an easy thing to talk about. I'm really, really lucky. I count myself as lucky because the people who were around me, my family, my friends, were brilliant and surrounded me and surrounded the boys and made sure that they were kind of like the structure around us that made it okay to carry on and to go back to work and to go to school and do all of those things. I was really lucky. I was lucky that my doctor knew the right phone number to give me to get in touch with the organisations that helped me. I was lucky that the people who greeted me when I walked into those organisations were amazing. You know, the support group I went to here in Liverpool, you know, you couldn't have walked into a better place. So I count myself as lucky, and I think the more that we can make sure that those right people have got the right phone numbers, or, you know, then that's what we do. You know, we kind of help each other, and I think being able to dip into those emotions when you need to, but also to be able to carry on with everyday life as well, is something that I've learned to do over the years.
Radio City Talk, tackling the stigma.
We have Angela's story on the programme today. She's been telling us in such a calm way, in such a measured way, her story. She lost her husband, Mark, to suicide. Angela, you've talked so much about this, and you worked on a documentary about this as well. You've sat in the all-party parliamentary group. You've worked with your own organisation as well. Can I ask you about language around suicide?
Yeah.
One of the things I've been very aware of, forgive me, you use the phrase, he took his life, and then some people say took his own life, lost his life to suicide, and then the now dreaded phrase is commit suicide, which is a phrase which is now almost being blacklisted, if you like. How importantly, or how closely do you sort of look to choose the right language when you're talking about your own story, your husband's story, and also trying to relate it to other people?
I think for people like me bereaved by suicide, I think it's once somebody starts using the right language, you're aware that somebody's being careful about the way that they're speaking to you. It makes you feel as if your experience is really valued. I think, you know, we try not to say the word committed, because obviously it's associated with when suicide was a criminal act. And so we try not to say committed. But, you know, these phrases are part of our everyday language. So I completely, you know, I know that sometimes it slips in and, you know, people say it because it's a phrase that we've all kind of grown up with. I think when somebody doesn't use it, I'm aware that they're not using it. And it kind of makes me feel as if, I want to talk to these people a bit more, you know. And I always feel as if it's just somebody being really mindful of the way that they're speaking to you. I think that committed is funny, because I have a real dichotomy with language, because I want people to talk about this desperately, really, really want them to talk about it. But what I don't want them to do is become so aware of their own language and what they shouldn't say and what they should say that it kind of stops them talking about it. When, you know, I had several people that I've known for a very long time cross the street from me when Mark died. And I thought it was because, I don't know, they didn't recognise me. What, they'd known me 20 years. They didn't recognise me, or maybe they didn't see me, or... And actually, when I've spoken to those people now, it's because they didn't know what to say to me. That's why they crossed the road. It was because they didn't know what to say. So I'd rather that somebody said, I don't know what to say to you, or use the dreaded word commit, than not speak to me at all. So it's a real tricky one, isn't it? The worst one that I really dislike is when somebody describes a suicide attempt as successful. And we get that a lot in the States. They talk about it being successful. Well, to people like me, it doesn't feel successful. It doesn't feel positive. It doesn't feel, you know, like that's the type of language we should be using. And I suppose if you have to use either committed suicide or the suicide attempt was successful, I'd probably go down the committed route. So it's language is so important, isn't it? And I think if you're somebody who's feeling suicidal and you want to talk about feeling suicidal, if somebody says to you, are you having dark thoughts? You're not going to do anything stupid, are you? Well, first of all, they're not necessarily dark thoughts, and that's such an odd way to describe them, and so loose that you could be talking about anything. But also, calling someone suicidal thoughts stupid or silly, they're not going to carry on having the conversation with you, are they, if they're if they're feeling suicidal? So we try and steer clear of that. If you're going to ask somebody if they're feeling suicidal, ask them if they're feeling suicidal. Have you thought about taking your life? Are you feeling suicidal? Once you start, not practicing saying it, but once you feel comfortable with saying it, it's amazing how easily the words will come out, but how welcomed they are by some people.
There might be people listening to this who would think that the response you would get from that might be to somebody or from somebody, well, I wasn't.
Yeah.
Until, I wonder if there's a danger sometimes that by planting that, it becomes she was thinking it.
Yeah, it's a myth. You know, you're not going to put the, we're not talking about which bread you're going to buy in Tesco here. We're not talking about being able to influence somebody kind of saying, oh, do you want to buy that instead? We're talking about a very serious issue. By asking somebody if they feel suicidal, you are not going to put the idea in their head. I can guarantee that. What you are going to do is open up a conversation that somebody might never have had before. And I think if somebody said to you, no, I'm not feeling suicidal, but actually I am feeling really down, or I'm not feeling suicidal, but I have in the past, or maybe they just say, yes, I am feeling suicidal, then you've opened up a conversation that could save somebody's life. But by not using those words and going all around the houses with our dark thoughts and our silly thoughts, that's not going to get you anywhere. It's just going to waste time that actually could be spent having a really important conversation.
In terms of those people who cross the road, what was the conversation maybe that you might expect from somebody who's been bereaved by suicide? What sort of conversation, or how should people approach? Because I guess people would think, well, they've been through such a terrible thing. I don't know or understand that thing. The best thing I can do is walk in a different direction, not even have that conversation. Is there a conversation? Is there a way to approach somebody who's found themselves bereaved in the way that you were to actually having that conversation? Does it have to be words? Can it be a look? Can it be a hug?
Just be really natural. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like that's what fuels the taboo. You know, people crossing the road and not saying anything to you. That fuels the taboo, and it makes people like me feel as if we're contagious. You know, to say to somebody, I don't know what to say to you. I can't even imagine what you're going through. Do you need some food? Do you need your kids taken to school? Do you need me to do some shopping for you? Do you want to come around for a cup of tea? They're all really, really helpful, because it's so isolating. When you're bereaved by suicide, it is so isolating, because people don't know what to say to you. They don't know what to do with you. They don't know. So the best thing that you can do is just be a friend and just say to somebody, you know, I don't know what to say to you, because then you're on a level with me then. You're not patronising me. You're not pretending it hasn't happened. You know, the worst thing you can say is, you know, how's the dog kind of thing. You know, it's like, yeah, Mark's just died. You know, so it's, I think the thing is, a hug kind of speaks volumes, doesn't it? But which is always great. But some people don't want any physical contact. So I think just be really, really honest and don't cross the road from people. It's much better to say, I don't know what to say to you.
I know you've done a lot of great work with Jake Mills from Chasing the Stigma. Yeah. Can I ask you about the stigma around suicide? When somebody sees you but they're crossing the road, I guess that's stigma.
Yeah.
In its plainest form, isn't it? That almost a sense that there is something hanging over your head,
yeah.
which is saying, don't approach this situation. You're not equipped to it. You're ignorant about it. I wonder how you feel about stigma, because of course there was Mark's situation, but then also the aftermath of it is something that you've dealt with and that you've seen. How widespread do you think that stigma has been, and do you think that it's changed in the last 14 years?
I think there's been a massive change. I genuinely do. I think there's been a massive change. I think there was several big watershed moments. One of them was around when we made our film, because there was a guy called Johnny Benjamin who also made a film at the same time, and we've become really good friends. And he made a film called The Stranger on the Bridge, it was about the search for the guy that stopped him from jumping from Waterloo Bridge. And I think people like Johnny and Jake, who will talk openly and honestly about their mental health and about their suicide attempts, that breaks the stigma more than anything. People like Jake, who is amazing. I'm a trustee of Chasing the Stigma and the Hub of Hope, that is just a great privilege to be associated with. You know, people talking, me, Jake, or everybody has lived experience. You know, one in four people will have a mental health issue during their lifetime. Imagine if that one in four people just talked about it openly, honestly. That is the type of thing that is absolutely instrumental in breaking down the stigma. Jake talking openly, you know, that to me is worth a million government documents. You know, yeah, I sit on the parliamentary group, and it's important, and it's important work. But the reason I sit on that is to get lived experience into that room. And there's many of us that do that. And I think that I'm an ambassador for SOBS, the Survivors of Bereavement by Suicide. And I became the head of that charity voluntarily. I wasn't paid for it. But I did that because that charity helped me so much. And that was just a room of people on Bold Street in Liverpool who'd all been bereaved by suicide, who put a cup of tea in my hand quicker than I've ever had a cup of tea put in my hand before, who just talked about this and talked openly and honestly. And the power of that was so brilliant that if I hadn't had all of those amazing people around me, people giving me the right information, I wouldn't be able to sit across the desk from you today. So I think that I now want to give a bit back and play my part in allowing other people to talk about their lived experience too.
I mean, that lived experience as well. I mean, in cynical radio terms, they used to be known as a case study.
Yeah.
Because it would be...
Yeah, I've had that against my name a few times.
But would it be... Here is an issue, find an expert on it, find a psychologist who can talk about it, then find a case study.
Yeah.
Maybe what I find with Mental Health Monday is that actually the lived experience, the people who are, they're almost the best people to turn to. Mm. It's almost, hear the stories first from the human being and then speak to the organisation, speak to the psychologist afterwards as well.
That's testament to people like you. I mean, you've been in this game a long time. Could you have seen that you would have 40 episodes of a podcast talking about mental health and that you could get in touch with somebody like me the day before or whatever and say, do you want to come on the show and just talk about this stuff? I mean, you must have seen a difference. You couldn't have envisaged that you would get 40 different people or 40, you know, coming on week after week after week, talking openly and honestly about that. You must have seen a difference.
Well, when we started, I'm giving away the tricks here. We said, well, let's do 6 weeks because 6 weeks is like a traditional run of a series of programs and then see what reaction there is and then bring it back if a few more people. Mm. But it was from week one that people would then go, oh, there's this. So then people came to us first and foremost to say, oh, well, we're involved in this one, or you might want to speak to this person. Mm. And then people would then hear the shared stories, the shared experiences, and then go, that sounds like me. I'm more than happy to talk about it. Other people would say, oh, I've written a blog as a result of such and such a thing. And then they'd come on and talk about maybe a blog post that they'd put on. And it kind of, it snowballs. Mm. And it snowballs, but it's based on that idea that if we weren't talking about it, then those people wouldn't have spoken about it. And if they hadn't have spoken about it, the other people wouldn't have heard it and they wouldn't have spoken. And you hope that it just kind of
And it is that ripple effect, isn't it? It is that ripple effect. And I think that's why programmes like this are so important, because it's every week. You know, you don't shy away from anything. You're having some really tricky conversations live on air. And it's that type of you know, people like you kind of championing the cause, allowing people to come on and talk about their experience that chips away at that stigma and chips away at the taboo. And hopefully it means if there's other people listening that have been bereaved by suicide, then they will just talk openly. Because my kids are 17 and 27 now. And I need to know that both of my boys, they're in the highest risk category. They're both male, they're both under 50, and they've been bereaved by suicide by the closest relative that you can get. They've lost their dad. My boys are in the highest risk category. I need to know that I'm doing my bit to create an atmosphere in which my kids can talk about it if they're not feeling okay. And that's ultimately the reason why I do everything that I do, is to make sure that I'm doing my bit to create that environment. And you're doing your bit as well to do that. So I thank you for that. But when you get your award, because you are going to get it, I'm going to put money on it. I've never bet it before, but I'm going to. Life After Suicide.
Check who else is in the category, by the way, before you do.
Listen, we were up for BAFTA, right? We got nominated to BAFTA, and Louis Theroux was in my category. And I didn't get it, but neither did Louis Theroux. So when we came off stage, it was kind of like he said to me, you know, I'm really sorry you didn't get it. And I kind of said, well, I kind of feel like I've won, because you've just said, you know, Louis Theroux is saying, I'm sorry your documentary didn't get it, you know, kind of. Yeah. So it's good to be nominated.
We've got to do out in in London on the 13th
It'll
of November.
Great.
It should be great. But you've got to do in London as well.
I have.
Tell us what's coming up at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, I've been invited to Buckingham Palace to meet with Prince William and Prince Henry on World Mental Health Day. And when I got the invitation through the post, you know, there's a million different bits of paper in with it. And it said kind of Prince Henry invites you to Buckingham Palace. So I immediately just thought it was someone playing a joke that somebody had written Prince Henry instead of Prince Harry. But indeed, that's his real name.
Is that what they put?
Yeah.
Did it say at brackets, it's Harry?
No,
obvs.
There wasn't like a little cartoon of like a guy with like red hair. No. So on World Mental Health Day, I'll be down there with lots of other mental health campaigners. And it's just an amazing thing to be able to support their work. You know, their work is amazing.
I mean, but some people don't like the royal family. But yeah, it's hard to criticise what they've done in terms of their mental health work, yeah, isn't it?
I met...
Particularly for you, who's about to go down there.
Exactly,
so, but if you want to criticise them on this programme...
I met William and Kate a little while ago because I received a call. I was in my dressing gown. I receive all the most important calls in my life when I'm in my dressing gown. And it was 8:30 in the morning and I got a phone call that said... Hello, Miss Samata, can I use your first name? And when someone asks permission to use your first name, you know it's either really good or really bad. And it was Kensington Palace, and they had seen the film and invited me, little Ange, for a private audience. And I immediately got cheeky, as we do in this part of the world, and said, this wasn't just about my experience, it's about others as well. And so I asked... I asked if I could take some other people with me who'd been bereaved by suicide, and they gave me 10 places. And I took 10 people, most people from around this area, into Kensington Palace with me, and we met with Kate and William. And we talked for an hour, and it was an incredible meeting because it was really the start of their Heads Together campaign. And it was about them sounding out people like us, whether we thought that they could do good by talking about their bereavement, losing their mum. You know, William was 15. And when we sat across the table, we talked very openly about our experiences, but he also talked openly about his. And it was an incredible meeting, and really, I've met with him since, and he talks about that meeting being absolutely pivotal to him being able to talk openly about his bereavement. So, I wasn't a fan of the royal family, but by the time I came out of there, I was getting like my Union Jack suit made and
waving
camping
the flags
out on the Mall.
So when's that?
So I go down to see them on the 10th of October.
Fantastic. Yeah. I got an email through, by the way. I'll just mention this one for the 10th of October, World Mental Health Day. The team at Access Sefton and Hugh Baird College have got a free event taking place called Find Your Balance, involving creative crafts, mindful colouring. There's a chill-out zone, hand and shoulder massage, body art, mindfulness and chair-based yoga, information and advice from health and wellbeing organisations, plus chance to win Everton tickets, signed Liverpool memorabilia and vouchers for local local stores and restaurants. That's taking place at the L20 University Centre, Hugh Baird College, between 10 and 3 on Tuesday, the 10th of October. So while you're mixing it with the Royals, Hugh Baird College is the place to be through Access Sefton.
I could just have a little massage before
absolutely.
I went down there.
It's on the corner of Stanley Road and Balliol Road in Bootle, if you know that part of town. That's Tuesday, the 10th of October, between 10 and 3. Angela, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's been great to get you on.
Thank you.
Really interesting the work that you're doing and continue to do as well. I wish you all the best for your trip down to the Palace as well. And I'm sure we will speak again in the very near future. Thank you for being so nice about the programme as well.
Thanks for having me.
I don't think I've ever been put on the spot like that with such warm compliments before. I just looked blankly back at you, didn't I?
It's all true. You did. It was kind of like role reversal for a second.
Thank you for your time. Angela Samata. It's Radio City Talk and Mental Health Monday.
Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
My name's Mick, and last week on Mental Health Monday, we were talking about the Liverpool Mental Health Festival. I'm very pleased to say today we have joining us on the programme the patron of the Liverpool Mental Health Festival, comedian Sophie Hagen joins us. Sophie, thank you for your time. Great to get you on the programme.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're originally from Denmark, and you find yourself as the patron of our local mental health festival. Was that a position you were happy to take up?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I was honoured to even be asked, yeah.
Just tell us about some of your own experiences when it comes to mental health. Why is it something that you're so passionate about?
Oh, God, how long do you have? I've had depression my entire life, which it's kind of fine now, but as you know, it never really goes away. I have anxiety, social anxiety, and I'm, I guess you'd say, survivor or a person who has experienced emotional abuse in my childhood. So, I mean, it's almost like a whole royal flush of mental health.
And in terms of how that has sort of travelled with you, if you like, from Denmark, now you kind of have this UK base. Have you found that mental health has certain boundaries? Do people have different experiences depending on how they've grown up? Or have you seen echoes of similar experiences, no matter what colour your passport is?
Yeah, I think maybe Denmark isn't further away than that. It's kind of a bit the same, I feel. But also, I'm in comedy, so the people I surround myself with are comedians, and we all have this has to be something wrong with you in order for you to become a comedian in the first place. So I am a bit, you know, surrounded by people who are who knows what it's about. And when I talk about it on stage, I get to meet my audience after the show, and a lot of them say that what I talk about in my experiences rings true to their experiences as well. So I do think it is kind of, I think we all have more or less the same experiences with how our mental health issues can kind of put boundaries for us.
And in terms of being a stand-up comedian, I mean, if you just went around saying, I'm going to do a talk about mental health, I'm not sure how many people would instantly go, great, Friday night, Saturday night, that's where I'm going to be. But actually, the craft of the comedian is one of storytelling, isn't it? You know, it's about setting, giving something of yourself, but also maybe surprising your audience with how you tell that story as well. Do you find that comedy is almost a great way of almost tricking people into hearing about mental health, of talking about mental health?
Yeah, I think so. I really think so. I mean, it's the only way I can really talk about it. But I remember the first time I saw a comedian talk about mental health, and it just shifted something in my brain. It was so empowering, because it's also about representation. Seeing someone talk about the thing that you're experiencing is so powerful. Because it's to a larger audience, and you know there are people in the audience who I'm now learning about this thing that I've been feeling my entire life. And that's empowering, because it's very rare that, up until recently at least, it's very rare to go to a comedy show and feel yourself be represented, unless you were, you know, a white, straight man talking about his wife being naggy, you know?
You've obviously studied a lot of male comedians in the UK.
I mean, they're great, but and they're funny and I love them, but it's not my experience, and it's rare that I hear someone stand on stage and talk about my life, you know, so I kind of have to do it myself.
What's it like after a show, Sophie, in terms of people who I presume, and we find it with our program when we do Mental Health Monday, people almost, when they hear something, they want to give a little bit of their, of something back. They feel like a need to share those stories. Do you find yourself talking for hours on end in the bar out the back or on the stage even with people who just say, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself?
I mean, in a kind of a tragic almost way, a lot of my audiences are kind of introverted and have social anxiety as well. So I often just get a tweet or an email saying, sure, I was too afraid to talk to you, which I can completely relate to. But I do hear some, I've had to be careful as well, because I've had to say to a few people, listen, I'm not a psychologist. I can't help you with this. You have to tell someone else, because this is not something I can take on me or fix or help you with. Because, and I totally understand that if it feels like everything is kind of falling apart for you, you want to tell someone you trust. And if they've seen me and they know that I had the same experience, they might think that I can say something to help. But sometimes people, I am just a comedian. I'm not a professional in mental health. So I've had to have that tough conversation where I've had to say, sorry, I can't. This isn't, you have to talk to a professional about this.
And I guess most people would say fair enough, but actually in maybe seeing your show, that person might, that might be the trigger in which they then go and start, you know, seeing somebody, or might take that different step. Your show is called Dead Baby Frog, and it's on at the Unity. I understand it's already sold out. There might be one or two house seats still available, but there are tickets available for the show at the Lowry Theatre as well. Sophie Hagen's with us, and the she's the patron of the Liverpool Mental Health Festival. For you, Sophie, do you find it a cathartic experience taking ownership of your experiences now and sort of telling those stories and having it as a tour where you go and you repeat those stories, obviously in different ways depending on the audience, but do you feel like you've almost grabbed ownership of the issues which have blighted your life?
Very much, very, very much, especially with my second show, of course I'm not doing it anymore, but it's filmed and it's on my website, people can buy it. That was about being an introvert and having social anxiety. And that was powerful because people would come up to me and say to me that they had the same experiences. And I kind of realized I wasn't the only person who was a weirdo when it came to not wanting to go to parties or talk to people. But with the new show, which is about my emotionally abusive grandfather, that's powerful in a whole other way, because I'm taking control of how my life is told, because he was such a controlling man that he would tell me he would tell me what I was meant to feel and what I was meant to say and what I was meant to do. And now I'm so extremely doing it on my own terms. So that's a whole other type of of empowering.
And in terms of with that in mind, when people go, might there be people who are surprised at what they might hear from you? There might be people who've had their own experiences. I noticed on the website there's almost a warning, if you like, that you're going to be talking about emotional abuse within a family relationship. And I wonder whether or not for some people they almost might get a shock that you are as open and honest as you are as part of the tour.
I hope it's a tough one, because I don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable about it, but I do know that it's a risk. And I've tried to make trigger warnings. I've tried to write it on, you know, social media. I've tried to write it on the website, the ticket link, just to make sure that people don't get an uncomfortable surprise. And I say it before I go on stage. I say, the show will be about emotional abuse. You can leave if you need to leave. Like, I won't be upset. And of course, being allowed to talk about it on shows such as this one hopefully also helps, because I don't want anyone to feel bad about it. But I've also tried to make sure that it's not just a sad story. You know, I feel like it has, I feel like once you've seen it, you wouldn't be too upset.
In terms of the tour as well, is described as being anxiety safe. How does that work out? What do you do? What steps are you able to take for people who suffer from anxiety, who maybe don't like the idea of having to sit in one seat for an hour or an hour and a half at a time in a place that maybe they don't know?
Well, it all stems from me having anxiety myself. So I know that it can differ from person to person. So basically, we do it on a case-to-case basis. So we have an email address, which is tour@sophiehagen.com, and people can get in touch and let me know if there is anything we can do, and if so, what is it, and then we'll see. So someone has, a lot of people want to sit by the aisle, in which case I'm going to put reserve signs on some aisle seats. some people want to just ask about the content, in which case I can answer their questions and tell them, you know, at what point do I mention what things. Some people want to be led into the room before the audience because they don't like being in a crowd. So it's kind of, we just take it on a case-to-case basis. And so far, we haven't had to say no to anyone. But of course, there's a risk that something can't be dealt with. But I really urge people to get in touch and let me know if I can do anything.
What a great idea, Sophie.
Thank you. I like it.
That's just such a... It's that thing, isn't it, where you're not just thinking, right, I'm going to go and do my show, I'm going to talk about myself, and then people are going to leave. You go, you know, people might talk to me afterwards, they might email me before, they might tweet me after, but also when they come into the show, I want to make the room as comfortable as possible as well. And it doesn't take a great deal, I'm sure, for those things, you know, reserve those seats, make sure that they're in play. You've got gender-neutral toilets as well, so that people might not be have issues with that as well. All the details of it, by the way, are on the Sophie Hagen website, sophiehagen.com. We'll get a link up on our social media. Thank you for your time, Sophie, today. When you come to Liverpool, big tower, pork pie dish on top, that's where we are. Do come and say hello, and I would love to get you on the programme face-to-face in the studio.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
This is Radio City Talk.